At this time, we don't think it was very many. We think it was less than 40 phone calls. That's what we've discovered up to date.
The corrections department says it's been recording phone calls between inmates and attorneys. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state makes the case for its new abortion restriction in court.
What this form does is simply put a very minor additional documentation requirement on the part of the doctor providing the service.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Department of Corrections says at least a few dozen phone calls between inmates in state prisons and their attorneys were inadvertently recorded. Officials with the department say they're still investigating the problem and cannot yet confirm that it's been corrected. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The confidentiality of conversations between attorneys and clients is a basic and sacred tenet of the criminal justice system in the U.S., and that's not a privilege that defendants or even the convicted forfeit when they're behind bars. The Alaska Department of Corrections' own policies and procedures states clearly that calls between a prisoner and an attorney may not be monitored except when authorized by court order.
Basically, sometime in the fall, it was brought to our attention that some attorney calls were being recorded. So we started looking into it at that time.
That's Casey Schroeder, a special assistant to DOC Commissioner Joe Schmidt. Schroeder says that after the department determined that, in fact, attorney-client calls had been or were being recorded at the state's correctional facilities, some steps were taken to correct the problem. But right now, there are more questions than solid answers, starting with exactly how many attorney-client phone calls were recorded.
We're still determining that. At this time, we don't think it was very many. We think it was less than 40 phone calls. That's what we've discovered up to date.
Now that the problem has been discovered, are phone calls between attorneys and clients in jail still being recorded?
We're doing our best to make sure it's not. I can't guarantee you, though, that it is not. So if you are beginning a phone call and it says you're being recorded, you are being recorded. The attorneys especially need to take heed to that message.
Schroeder says corrections is in the process of destroying material that shouldn't have been recorded. But can the department confirm that those tapes haven't been listened to by law enforcement or state prosecutors?
Not at this time. That would be part of the investigation.
She says that investigation will also determine whether any specific criminal cases have been jeopardized by the recorded conversations. Phone communications at Alaska's correctional facilities are handled by Dallas, Texas-based Securus, which has contracts with some 2,200 facilities in 45 states, according to the company's website. The communication system is automated and is supposed to provide an easy way to monitor and record all of the phone traffic for the state's inmate population, minus with their attorneys and a few others entitled to confidentiality. The system also puts time limits on calls and can block certain numbers to prevent harassment. It is also supposed to automatically not record calls to the listed numbers of registered defense attorneys. Corrections says they're working with Securus to figure out what went wrong with the system. The state's public defender agency says it is aware of at least one phone call between an agency attorney and a client that was recorded. In an email, Deputy Public Defender for the Criminal Division, Douglas Moody, said that until the agency has some assurance that the problem is fixed, they will assume that DOC is listening to all of the conversations between inmates and public defense attorneys. Other attorneys are also concerned about the recorded phone calls.
That's very troublesome, I'm sure, for practically any attorney.
That's Rex Lamont Butler, an Anchorage-based private attorney known to tackle some high-profile defense cases.
It's bad enough that we've got clients spread out all over the state now and jails that you can that it takes hours to get to. But then when you get a client on the phone, if they cannot rest assured that they're getting attorney-client privilege, then of course it chills our ability to do our job. I really want to be comfortable in knowing that my conversation with my client is going to be confidential. I have to have that.
Butler says that the Department of Corrections needs to provide attorneys with a list of the calls that were monitored or recorded. He says the department also needs to provide assurances that the problem has been fixed and that the tapes have been destroyed. The department says it's working on those things, but it could still take weeks or even months to get it sorted out. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Attorneys for Planned Parenthood and the state of Alaska argued before Judge John Suttuck in a court hearing in Anchorage Superior Court today. Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit against the state last week, objecting to new limitations being placed on abortions paid for by Medicaid. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Planned Parenthood filed the lawsuit against the Alaska Department of Social Services last Wednesday. They object to the state trying to limit abortions paid for by Medicaid by narrowing the definition of when an abortion is medically necessary. Attorney Janet Kreps argued by phone on behalf of Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest. She asked Judge John Suttuck to issue a temporary restraining order suspending the state regulation, saying it could harm women who rely on Medicaid.
The inability to obtain a medically necessary abortion or delay that unnecessarily increases the risks of the procedure are irreparable harm that justify the issuance of a temporary restraining order.
Kreps said she worried about women with certain forms of diabetes or mental illness not qualifying for abortions if they need them. Initially, the case was assigned to Judge Mark Ridner on Friday, but the state of Alaska objected to him as the judge. Judge Gregory Miller was assigned the case the same day, but he recused himself. Then the case was assigned to Judge Suttuck. State Attorney Stacy Crayley argued it would be fine to let the regulation stay in effect while the judge decides the case. The Department of Health and Social Services wants doctors to fill out a sheet checking off why an abortion should be reimbursed. Crayley said the additional documentation is not that big of a deal.
What this form does is simply put a very minor additional documentation requirement on the part of the doctor providing the service to articulate that they believe in their medical judgment that the service that they are providing is medically necessary.
The regulation requiring the additional paperwork was introduced in August by Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Bill Strer. The regulation went into effect over the weekend. Doctors must now fill out a new form to certify that a woman is in imminent danger of medical impairment of a major bodily function in order to qualify for an abortion paid for by Medicaid. Judge Suttuck expressed concern that mentally ill women might not qualify for abortions under the new regulation.
A woman who's bipolar, if she doesn't take her medication, she's reverberating between a manic state and a depressive state. And it's no fun, and it has practical effects on all aspects of daily life, living, job, relationship, ability to provide childcare. For the woman, but if she goes off her medications, is she really in imminent danger of medical impairment of a major bodily function?
Jim Minnery with the conservative group Alaska Family Action complained that Judge Suttuck could not be impartial in the case because his former law partner had argued cases about abortion.
We're very disappointed that the state of Alaska didn't accept Judge Suttuck's offer to recuse himself from this case. It's that simple. We very much think that there's a conflict of interest.
Judge Suttuck said he'll rule swiftly on whether to issue a temporary restraining order suspending the state regulation until the case is decided. Planned Parenthood has also requested a preliminary injunction, which would suspend the state regulation for a longer period if the case takes more time. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The State Department of Public Safety is reviewing its safety procedures following a helicopter crash that took the lives of three men in March of last year. The crash is still under investigation. The Alaska State Trooper's Hilo 1 crashed near Talkeetna during a rescue mission, killing its pilot, a state trooper, and one civilian. Trooper Director Colonel Jim Cockrell says the National Transportation Safety Board has pointed out some concerns that need to be addressed.
Including reviewing all our internal policies regarding our use of our aircraft with our department pilots. We're hiring a safety manager or safety officer to oversee all aspects of safety at the aircraft section. We've hired a new aircraft supervisor with an extensive aviation background, and same with a new commissioned lieutenant we put in the aircraft section.
Cockrell says the NTSB recommendations are not directly related to last year's accident. In addition to the three new hires, the troopers are now evaluating aviation training programs and are making changes in risk assessment. The decision to send trooper aircraft out on a mission will no longer be on one person's shoulders.
People's lives are definitely at risk, and it's hard for our personnel who's joined the department to provide public service. It's hard for them sometimes to say no, and that's why we want to make sure that we have someone outside the, if you want to call it the loop, that makes a decision if it's worth our risk to handle this call.
Troopers are working with the NTSB to determine the cause of the 2013 Hilo 1 crash. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the front runners on the Yukon Quest talk strategy.
The biggest challenge is to hold them back. It has been from the start. My foot's been on the drag or brake.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
This week, the Board of Fish is dealing with contentious battles over Cook Inlet salmon. Johanna Urich reports that in both the Kenai and the Matsu boroughs, many are fighting over fish that are disappearing.
80-year-old Eric Barnes described how his fishing had been cut back and back again to allow more king salmon up the Kenai, while at the same time, those kings were disappearing. He says the problem is in the river, pointing to the ghosts of the iconic 50 to 70-pound old kings that are gone and replaced by much smaller jacks that now dominate a run predicted to fall way below the numbers needed. He says the big kings targeted by sports fishermen in the rivers are needed to make more big fish and healthy runs.
Of course, our goal today is to decouple so we're not attached to the problems that they're doing in the river. We don't want to be closed because they need to be closed. Our being closed won't solve the problem.
Sports fishermen used to hang out at tributaries of the Kenai, like the mouth of the Funny River, to catch the big giants pictured in tourist brochures. Those fish are gone. Biologists predict only one 7-year-old king will swim up the river this summer. Gerald Brell is a sports fisherman who has a summer home on the Kenai River. He wants the board to bring those big fish back and is willing to stop fishing for kings. But he says the set net fishery should also be closed down.
Most sports fishermen in my group of homeowners association would be willing not to fish king salmon. That's a real hard statement to make. So if we're willing to give that up, maybe other groups need to give up a little too.
The low number of kings is statewide, not just on the Kenai. The problem is worse in Cook Inlet because there are more people who want those prized sport fish, and many of them well-heeled and politically connected. In Cook Inlet, there is still a healthy run of sockeye salmon that supports a fleet of commercial fishermen along with set netters. Sports fishing interests want the board to let more reds through to get more kings up the Kenai. That strategy may backfire because the smolts or baby salmon may not have enough to eat in the lakes and streams when they hatch. For the folks further up Cook Inlet in the Matsu Borough, the idea of letting more fish through the commercial fleet is exactly what they want. Jennifer Amon with the Matsu Fish and Game Advisory Council says there are not enough fish in Matsu Borough streams, whether they're talking sockeyes, kings, or the silvers that once brought sports fishermen and fueled a thriving guide business.
The reality of this situation is this meeting is really going to be a turning point. We're relying on our Board of Fisheries to really turn this decline around and change the management strategy for this mixed stock fishery we've got in Upper Cook Inlet.
The Matsu Advisory Board wants to change the way the state manages the commercial fleet so fisheries are open based on escapement to each of the inlet's rivers. They want to force drift boats to deploy their nets closer to the river mouths so more of the salmon headed to the top of Cook Inlet can get through. That would be bad news for Homer, where half of the Cook Inlet drift fleet is located. Walter Reedy, the city manager, predicts that plan would take the fleet away from Homer, where it is a strong part of the community's economy.
There would be a real ripple effect throughout the economy. We've got an open access fish dock that's got 9 cranes. We've got a big ice plant there and fish grinders and cold storage. And, you know, that stuff is there for a reason because the fishing happens right off the coast of Homer.
Drift boats pay about $900,000 a year for the local harbor. The proposals being presented to the board don't address what wild salmon need to survive and thrive. Not much is known of what happens when the fish leave the rivers to spend most of their life out at sea. The state has funded studies of king salmon to better understand that decline. Looming over the battles over Cook Inlet salmon is the long history of the extinct wild salmon runs in the lower 48 and Europe due to increased development and habitat loss in the streams they depend on to start their lives. Bob Shavelson with the Cook Inlet Keeper says Alaska's following that trail.
And we're seeing the exact same thing unfolding here in Cook Inlet, particularly in the Mattsu Valley. We're seeing a lot of it in the Kenai Peninsula, and we literally have a habitat crisis, and no one's talking about it, no one's really doing much about it.
No one I spoke with at the Cook Inlet Board of Fish meeting was optimistic about the future of wild salmon here. Some said it might be possible if all the different user groups could get together and stop fighting. I'm Johanna Urich.
Environmental officials are reviewing cleanup work conducted at a former military test site south of Delta Junction. The Gerstle River site was used by the Army to test chemical and biological agents during the height of the Cold War. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Army created the 20,500-acre Gerstle River test site in the early 1950s to determine how high explosives and chemical and biological warfare agents would work in the Arctic. The site is about 35 miles southeast of Delta, within a few miles of where the Gerstle flows into the Tanana River. Substances tested at the site during those years include mustard gas, nerve gas, including sarin, and the biological agent tularemia. The Army conducted several cleanups around the site before and after it was shut down in the early 1970s. It's also monitored and periodically tested the area. But Army officials aren't sure whether they've compiled all the data that's been collected and whether they know all there is to know about the site. So they're taking another look to plug the data gaps, says Brian Adams, project manager with Fort Wainwright's Environmental Office.
Plugging those holes is key to doing the cleanup of the site.
Guy Warren is an environmental program specialist with the State Department of Environmental Conservation who's working with the Army on the data gap analysis. He says the Army launched this latest rounds of studies on the site after it got funding for the project last year.
They've hired a contractor that's going back and looking through all the different reports that we have to kind of get a picture of what do we know today about the history, the use, and the disposal of chemical weapons and other contaminants on that property.
Warren says this new round of analysis will pick up on the work of a previous round, which petered out about 12 years ago.
I don't think anything was ever really finalized with the public. You know, there were still some questions out there about, you know, what may be left on the site.
Adams says the Army also is reforming an advisory committee that was disbanded about 12 years ago when Greeley was closed after it landed on the 1995 base realignment and closure list. Adams is now looking for about 20 people to serve on the Reclamation Advisory Board. He says he'd especially like to get residents of the Delta Junction area and from Healy Lake, Dot Lake, and Toke to serve on the board. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Electronic health records free Alaskans from the paper chase by giving doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where they need it. Electronic health records increase safety and security. Electronic records take health information out of the filing cabinet and into the digital light. You can find out more at ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
Tongass Democrats have nominated Jesse Keel, Sam Keto III, and Catherine Reardon to fill the House District 32 seat vacated last month by Juneau Representative Beth Curtula. Nine Juneau Democrats applied for the seat, which includes downtown Juneau and Douglas, Petersburg, Gustavus, Skagway, and Tenekee Springs. The three finalists were chosen after public interviews over the weekend. Former Juneau Mayor Bruce Botello chaired the selection committee. He says everyone who applied represents mainstream Democratic values.
We did a very extensive vetting process, both in the form of questionnaires, background checks, and interviews with each of the candidates. It was a very difficult selection process in the sense that we had strong candidates.
Keel is an aide to Juneau Senator Dennis Egan and serving his first term on the Juneau Assembly. Quito is a civil engineer who's been working in recent years as a legislative lobbyist for an engineering firm. He says his work as a lobbyist would not affect his opinions as a legislator. Reardon has been a division director in the Alaska Department of Commerce and now works as a legislative aide for Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson. Governor Parnell has 30 days to fill a legislative seat once it has been vacated. Curtula resigned on January 24th to take a position at Stanford University's Center for Ocean Solutions. After a year of meetings, the legislature's Arctic Policy Commission is rolling out its strategy for the region. The draft report offers recommendations on how to manage maritime commerce and resource development in the Arctic, how to improve emergency response, and how to include the state's indigenous population in policy discussions. Representative Bob Heron, a Bethel Democrat who co-chaired the commission, says having an Arctic thought process puts the state on better footing with the federal government when it comes to having a say in policy for the region.
We want to be in the center of all those decisions.
The Arctic Policy Commission's work may have a more immediate influence on the state's own policy. The report identified the lack of infrastructure as a key problem for the region, and Heron and his fellow co-chair, Senator Liesl McGuire, each introduced legislation to address that last week. One bill would create a port authority for the Arctic, while the other would authorize the state to issue loans for projects like roads and harbors. McGuire acknowledges Arctic development will be expensive and difficult to afford, given the state is looking at a budget shortfall. Still, she sees it as a necessary investment.
I think we're going to have to start looking at it right now. We're already behind.
The Obama administration offered its own strategy for the Arctic region last week. 2.5 months after severe flooding ruined homes and vital infrastructure, Stebbins is organizing to put recovery funds toward fixing long-standing problems exacerbated by the storm damage. President Obama declared November's storms in western Alaska a natural disaster last month, unlocking federal funds to help the community. KNOM's Zechariah Hughes reports.
Most of the homes in Stebbins don't have sewer or water. The provisional remedy, a honey bucket hauling system, created a serious health hazard when floodwater spilled several across a marshy plain just behind a row of homes, which has since frozen over. Residents and officials were worried what would happen to the contamination when the ground thawed in the spring. Sitting in her narrow office with files spread across her desk, City Administrator Nora Tom said signs of contamination started appearing even earlier.
After the storm, we had close to 10 dogs that were reported that they died, in fact, from being sick, and they had signs of E. coli.
Residents took precautions and threw out household goods and stores of food. The Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation sent 3,000 pounds of halibut and salmon in response to a request from the IRA for help with community-wide losses of fish and meat in the storm. Morris Neshonek is mayor of Stebbins and says the top priority working with the state and federal funders is the town's water system.
Currently, our water and sewer has been on hold for many, many years. The flood from recent flooding has put us in a situation where the state and the federal have to look in to try and speed the process of getting the water and sewer for Stebbins.
Though water and sewer have been development priorities in Stebbins for decades, local officials are now approaching it as an essential disaster mitigation measure, just like their calls for a protective seawall. a lot of the vital infrastructure in Stebbins is not just outdated, it's right in the path of ocean flooding that's only getting worse as storms intensify, freeze-ups lengthen, and the beachfront erodes. The school's large cylindrical gas tanks are just on the other side of a thin, improvised dirt road across from the water. There's still a knee-high, rust-colored watermark from November's flooding on them. Nearby is a thin yellow spigot jutting out of the earth towards the sea ice. It's the hookup for gas deliveries, and it's surrounded by driftwood and a crumpled boat left over from the storm months ago. Mayor Neshonek says that rather than relying on consultants and outside engineering firms for management of the projects, as they did in the past, the city is reorganizing to lobby and labor on its own behalf.
With our group of people that have knowledge of trying to attain some funding sources would be more of a mark to the community, because the community can be able to stand up on their own and lobby for themselves.
The Department of Homeland Security has helped residents since the storms catalog property damage and should be dispersing funds in the next few months. But the leadership in Stebbins is working on solidifying priorities to capitalize on FEMA money that could make a long-term difference for the community's safety and well-being. The hope is to present a list of needs to representatives in Juneau during this current legislative session in order to spur action in time for the cleanup efforts set to resume in the spring. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A front of the pack is beginning to shake out on the Yukon Quest Trail. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The sky was still pitch black when Brent Sass sped into the circle checkpoint with a dog team that just wasn't ready to stop. As Sass walked up and down the line of dogs, he mumbled to his handler. "I'm fresh as can be," he said. He told Steve Stoller he had gotten 2 hours of solid sleep on the trail.
Dogs are raring to go. And he looks well-rested, and he's pumped, as usual.
Sass jumped on the runners and took off for the Yukon River nearly as quickly as he arrived. Behind him, Alan Moore was prepping his dog team to leave. Moore says his team wants to run at full bore down the hard-packed trail.
The biggest challenge is to hold them back. It has been from the start. My foot's been on the drag or brake. Because the conditions are like this tabletop here.
But he's quick to add that there's still roughly 800 miles of trail ahead.
You know, we're just jockeying for position right now.
On the Yukon Quest Trail in Circle, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ellen Lockyer, Daisha Eaton, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.